Scientists think they are close to solving the mystery over why Saturn's moon Iapetus has a two-tone appearance. The satellite has a black surface facing in the direction it travels and a white surface bringing up the rear. New data from the Cassini spacecraft seems to confirm that Iapetus is picking up dusty material on its bow front. But they say the mission scientists, this material is being warmed by the sun's rays, making it go even darker as it loses water vapor. There are fascinating things going on in space. We're going to talk with Richard C. Hoagland and Mike Barra, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, as well as the golden anniversary of the dawning of the space age. They're both next on Coast to Coast AM. Two special guests for you tonight. First of all, let me introduce Mike Barra. Mike Barra is an aerospace engineering consultant with more than 25 years in the field. He has worked for many giants in the industry, including Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and has worked on numerous airplane projects, including the Boeing 737, 757, 777, and the F-35 fighter program. He has worked closely with Richard C. Hoagland since 1998 and is the author or co-author of numerous articles for the EnterpriseMission.com website. He is also the curator of the LunarAnomalies.com, a website dedicated to independently investigating the possibility of artificial structures on the moon. We'll talk about that tonight as well. He is the co-author with Richard C. Hoagland of the new book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, Mike Barra. Mike, welcome back to Coast. How are you?
I'm doing great, George. How are you?
I think for you, full show, it's been about 4 years. Is that true?
Yeah,
my
correct.
Gosh, long time. And of course, Richard C. Hoagland, former Space Science Museum curator, former NASA consultant during the historic Apollo missions to the moon, was science advisor to Walter Cronkite, CBS News. He is also leading these scientific team, critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on the moon and Mars. And Richard, of course, has the two websites, enterprisemission.com and with Mike Barra, darkmission.net. He, of course, is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Richard. How are you? Looking forward to this.
George, you know, we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. We're going to blow a lot of people's minds. And by the end of the evening, I think life is going to be a little different for a lot of folks than it is right now.
Well, I've been looking forward to this, Richard, for a long, long time, and you are too. And Richard, tell me about the metamorphosis, the partnership here with Mike with the book Dark Mission. How did this evolve?
Well, Mike came kind of, you know, onto my radar several years ago. How long is it now, 10 years?
It's 9 years, but yeah, it was 1998.
Okay, nine and counting.
Yeah.
Through a mutual friend of ours who we'll get to later in the show. I don't want to give away some of the surprises. And the first thing I noticed is that Mike was an engineer who could write. He actually could put down coherent sentences, and he does it much more quickly than I do. I mean, I agonize over, you know, what's his name used to say, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. And I agonize over the lightning, and Mike just somehow seems to find the words, and they're right most of the time the first time. So because I set up this website, Enterprise Mission, back in 96 with the help of Art and with Keith Rowland, I then found that having a website was like having a wife. It was very demanding. And I needed help to do quality research and quality writing about that research. So I'm not quite sure to this day how I inveigled Mr. Barra into writing with me on these subjects and helping with the research, but I'm telling you, It was the best thing that ever happened to Enterprise and to what we've been trying to get out to people over the last almost 10 years. And the ultimate culmination was we were talking one day and we kind of said, hey, you know, we probably should do a book on this stuff together. And that was the, as they used to say, the rest is history.
Well, Mike, you have heard Richard on the program for years with us. Are we, or is Richard taking undue pot shots at NASA?
Well, the short answer to that is categorically no. I was listening to him back before I even knew him in the early days of Coast to Coast AM when Art was the host. And the thing that always intrigued me and always impressed me and made me want to work with him was the incredible detail that he always went into to explain how he got to a certain conclusion. And sometimes I think people don't follow that entire journey, or they don't quite grasp, you know, how he got from point A to point B. But Richard and I think alike. He has an engineer's brain in a lot of ways, and he anticipates, you know, what is a critical person, what is a critical thinker going to ask, what are they going to challenge me on? So I think he does an incredibly thorough job, and really what I've found, and I think I even wrote this in a piece after he got attacked by the Skeptical Inquirer folks a few years ago.
I remember
that. Basically, his critics fall into two categories, liars and idiots. And there's a lot of idiots.
Now, I don't want you to pull your punches tonight, Mike. Just tell it like you really feel.
Right, exactly. That's me. I always hold back. You know, his critics fall into those two categories. And I even wrote an article once quite a while ago, you know, where's the informed criticism of Richard? And his critics just don't argue with him on the merits of the information or the data. They want to, you know, talk about sidelight issues or go into personal attacks. And to me, that's the first sign of a weak argument. So I think, if anything, you know, we're not as tough on NASA as we could be.
What got you, Richard C. Hoagland, to begin to look at NASA in a different light, a light of more inquisitiveness and more frustration, too?
Well, I started out, you know, with the dumb but honest theory.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking at the Cydonia data, the face on Mars, the pyramids, and then really the numbers, because as one of the famous astronomers of the last century, Arthur Eddington, said over and over again to his Victorian audiences of peers, gentlemen, he says, you don't have a science unless you can express it in numbers. Well, I had come at Cydonia with the idea that there were numbers, that there was alignments, there was the diameters of things matched, there was the obvious intelligent design of architecture. You know, if you run some of this data by people that don't know what planet they're looking at, they inevitably say, oh, those are aerial photographs of ruins. It's only when you tell them where they are that they suddenly get the collywobbles and say, I didn't really mean ruins. I mean, those could just, you know, sand dunes. Or it's kind of like when John West showed the water-eroded Sphinx to the English geologist,
right,
by covering the head with a piece of cardboard, and he got absolute 100% agreement that this is water erosion until he removed the cardboard and showed that it was the Sphinx. Then they all freaked out and threw him out of their offices. So what I found we're dealing with is a combination of dumbness. There's an awful lot of educational dysfunction, even if you have a PhD. I mean, the story that you led with about Iapetus, wait till you see what the real story of Iapetus is going to be. And I'm going to preview right now that it's going to knock your socks off. And for those folks that come to our LA event on November 4th, which is linked to both websites, we're going to give you a sneak preview of some amazing stuff that, frankly, the NASA folks appear to be honest but very, very dumb about. I mean, it's like every time they see a circular feature in the solar system, they automatically knee-jerk think crater, 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 crater. And they can't get out of that crater consciousness. Well, there are other things that are circular in the solar system besides craters on planets. So we're going to have a lot of fun showing people data and showing how we arrived at those conclusions. But back to your question, when did I begin to kind of wise up about NASA? When I realized that when we put out good arguments, substantive arguments, arguments backed up by evidence, by reasoning, by papers, by logic, by evidence, and the critics instead would basically make personal attacks on me or would haul some straw man up and then, you know, basically try to blow it away, I realized that nobody could be this dumb. Certainly not people that made it to the most prestigious offices on the planet, i.e. at NASA. And it was when Stan McDaniel, who was a professor and epistemologist, who, for those of you who haven't brushed up on your, you know, Latin lately, is a guy who studies the science of how we know what we know, which is very important to this whole conversation, because there's a lot of assumptions people make, not realizing they're making assumptions in going from A to B to C to dismissing the evidence. So when Stan McDaniel called me and we got into conversation on the phone, this was kind of before the days of email, back in the late 80s, early 90s, and told me he was going to be doing a report on the whole Cydonia Mars question. Would I assist him by pointing him in certain directions? Would I give him contact people, info, NASA people? Would I provide photographs, which of course I did? As Stan was writing his book, his own research discovered that not only was NASA not being candid, but he caught them in outright blatant lies again and again and again. So it really wasn't me who was hard-edged at that point. This is back in the early 90s, 92. It was Professor Stan McDaniel who actually went on to accuse NASA when they suddenly lost Mars Observer just before they got to Mars, which was a few days after they received his full report, in which Stan had said that the way they were going to deal with Cydonia in the Mars Observer mission was about the most egregious crime in the history of science. They were about to commit the most egregious crime in the history of science. Well, it was at that point that I realized that I was not alone, that there were actually objective people who had nothing to gain, had no vested interest, no dog in the fight, as they say, who had independently, based on the evidence provided and the evidence they'd found on their own, had independently come to the realization that NASA does not tell the truth. And it's a terrible thing for me to say tonight, but Dark Mission is a compendium of countless examples of NASA not just fudging things or spinning things, which is the current term in Washington, but outright lying.
Tonight,
again,
we will
make very clear, let me finish this point.
All right, go ahead.
I want to make very clear that 99.9% of the people that work for NASA tonight would be shocked if they were to hear me say that, because they're not doing it. They themselves are being lied to, and they don't have any defense mechanism because they have been inculcated from almost birth. Some of them have been there that long. That we're the most, you know, open agency in the federal government. We don't do things like other agencies. We don't, prevaricate. We don't fudge data. We don't do this. And they themselves will be shocked as they go through Dark Mission and look at example after example that we document where they themselves are also being lied to.
Do you pick up Dark Mission from the NASA of old or the NASA of new?
We go back to the very beginning.
All right.
Very beginning. We trace it from its origins after World War II, the segue from the NACA, which was the National Aeronautics Commission, which was the premier federal research agency trying to get us, you know, up the curve of flight for military and civilian aircraft technology.
Right.
That then was transitioned over into NASA per General/President Eisenhower's dictum that we should have a civilian space agency. Well, the first lie that we have to confront in the book and on the show tonight is the idea that NASA is a civilian space agency.
Was it ever?
Never. That's the first huge lie, which means if you go through the documents that we cite in the beginning of the book, the president and the National Security Agency and the Security Council and all of the alphabet agencies that basically are supposed to keep us safe and keep secrets from our enemies, they have under law a perfect right constitutionally to censor any and all information that NASA comes up with that would impinge on national security. And, of course, the ruins of an ancient extraterrestrial civilization fall right in that category. And so from the get-go, NASA has been compelled by law to lie to all the rest of us and maintain that it's not even part of the DOD.
Well, I can't wait to get into some of these structures, too. Go ahead, Mike Barrett.
Well, I was going to say, George, the other thing is that if the solar system was what NASA says it is, which is this dead, boring, lifeless place with nothing interesting at all on the moon or on Mars, why would anything about a civilian space program need to be classified? Why would there need to be a requirement in the original act that created the agency that says, hey, the president and the DOD are going to have the final say on classifying any discoveries that NASA might make? They simply wouldn't have to have that requirement if the solar system was really as dead and boring as they've claimed for 50 years.
Mike, was there anything in the book while you were doing it with Richard that you two did not agree on?
You know, I think there's one thing, and it was the wording at the end of one particular chapter, which has to do with President Kennedy. And I think it's a little too early to actually get to that that part of the book, to tell you the
right.
truth. There's a lot of ground to cover before we really talk about that particular conclusion.
Okay, but you didn't see eye to eye on everything.
No, we don't. We don't. And we will argue things, and we'll also argue about the priority of things.
And I want you to do that tonight. If there's something that Richard or you say, I want
right.
you two to jump in as we continue this discussion.
I don't know,
and,
George, we're both
lay it out.
Violets. I'm
yeah, and it's also frightening to some people, my ex-wife, I think, particularly, how much we think alike. So we don't disagree on a whole lot.
Well, which one of you was saying that a website is much like a wife?
Yeah, it's... well, I want to distance myself from that comment immediately.
But you're not married now.
No, but I do work on your website.
And I would distance myself from that too, Richard. So you're out there hanging all by yourself.
Oh, thanks so much, guys.
Hey, you know, the most disappointing thing I've heard from NASA of recent was what Administrator Mike Griffin said last week, Richard, when you were on to React. And that was basically saying China's going to beat us back to the moon. Because I see the moon race as being two. There was moon race number one with the race with the Soviets, and we beat them to the moon. And then there was moon race number two with this incredible new technology, this new innovation. We need to win again. It's like game two of a playoff series. And he admitted that the Chinese are going to beat us back to the moon. I find that unacceptable, Richard.
Well, let me start with prefacing that Mike actually, for all his military and civilian aircraft experience at Boeing and those other aerospace companies, lost a bet to me. Because he was working for Northrop Grumman when I told him several times in email, so I have records, that...
And you're talking about Mike Barra lost the bet, not Mike Griffin.
No, Mike Barra, yeah.
Right.
That the company he was working for was going to lose the contract for the spacecraft, later dubbed Orion, to take, you know, American astronauts back to the moon as part of the president's vision articulated in January of 2004, and articulated by Mike Griffin, you know, a year or two later when he was appointed administrator, and you know, onward thus, and so I predicted that he would not get the contract, that he would probably be fired, which happened, but that he would then be rehired, probably by another company, which was going to get the subsequent contract, or maybe even the same company, because in addition to the Apollo-style spacecraft that they've created now called Orion, which we explain in exquisite detail in Dark Mission, what that all really, 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 really means. We also need another lunar module. There needs to be a spacecraft which goes down to the surface of the moon like the good old-fashioned LEM in Apollo and comes back up and rendezvous with the Orion slash Apollo, you know, redo spacecraft and comes back home. So I think Mike is going to wind up working for the very mission that we're discussing in Dark Mission, and wouldn't that be incredibly ironic?
Well, as long as it gets me out of Seattle, dreary Seattle, and into beautiful, sunny Los Angeles.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with Seattle. I was up there for a book signing, Michael. It's a gorgeous city.
It's a gorgeous city on a sunny day, George.
You don't get a lot of sun there?
No.
Anyway, back to your question. I cannot, in all fairness, understand what Mike Griffin is up to. Because Mike Griffin has been tasked by our president, by the nation, because the president is elected by all the people, to basically get back to the moon as rapidly as is practicable within the fiscal constraints that he's been given. And instead, they have created this monster, both engineering and political monster, that is spending money like it's going out of style, not producing a viable spacecraft, i.e. Apollo on steroids, which is what he actually called it when he debuted it a couple of years ago to the entire world press corps. I mean, that's such a derogatory comment for a nation that's supposed to be leading. They've had engineers, NASA people, scouring the country, going to museums, taking pictures, trying to figure out how the Apollo guys managed to create Apollo in the first place.
Exactly. Richard, stay with us. We'll be back with both you and Mike Barra. We'll get into Dark Mission. We'll talk about the structures that could be on the moon and Mars as well. and the rest of the solar system and beyond. Well, Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra make some pretty startling claims in their book, Dark Mission. And we're going to hold them to the fire, try to find out exactly how and why they came up with these theories. They're both next on Coast to Coast AM. Richard C. Hoagland, Mike Barra. Richard, go ahead and finish up there on your statement about Mike Griffin giving the Chinese the nod to basically get there before we do again.
Well, at this point, I got to tell kind of a tale out of school. You know that I have sources.
Yes.
You know that there are some intelligence people.
Though you won't tell me who they are.
Well, I can't.
Richard, it's me.
Cronkite would be unhappy if I did. He's the one that taught me you don't reveal sources. And two, if you do, you know, seriously, if you do, you know, release the name of a source that doesn't want to be named, that source goes away.
And so do all the others, Richard.
Exactly, because of the ripple effect, and they can't trust you to keep confidence and all that. So, I mean, if it was, remember Connie Chung?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
just being you and me, George. All the millions of people now listen to your radio, turn off your radio, and I'm just going to tell George, see, it doesn't work that way. Anyway, so one of our key sources, when the president made the announcement some, what is it now, 3 years ago in 2004, that we're going back to the moon and on to Mars, we're going to reinvigorate the program that was suspended almost in mid-flight, mid-pause, mid-sentence called Apollo, this intel source called me and said, basically, it's a trap. It's fake. Don't believe it. They don't mean a word of it. And I was obviously very skeptical because there's a whole bunch of reasons why I think that this nation has to go back to the moon.
You think it was smoke and mirrors, though?
Well, what he basically said was it was going to be a con game. What it was going to be is what Mike and I predicted in a piece called Oh My God, They Killed Soho. When did we write that, Mike?
1998, as a matter of fact.
98. Which is 9
years ago. Nine and a half years ago.
Yeah. It was one of our first pieces. We predicted this is exactly what would have to happen. So this intel source basically says it's a con game to get the Congress and the people and the press thinking that we're making stuff to go to the moon. And it will get all snarled up in the bureaucracy and over budgets and cost overruns and all that. And we'll wind up not having anything that can really go in the open white world, that the real action would take place in the secret space program that you and I have discussed, George, many times on the show, as well as others, people like John Lear, and that that's where the real action is going to be. And that what we're seeing in public, or what when he told me this, it hadn't happened yet, that it would be merely a kind of a clever way of convincing the press and the Congress that they were trying, but there would be insurmountable problems down the road. Well, that was 3 years ago. Now you look at Mike Griffin, former CIA Mike Griffin. You knew that, right?
Yes.
That Mike Griffin was former member of the intelligence community himself?
Well, I had heard it. I don't know it in quotes.
Just do a search on Mike Griffin CIA. And you'll find all kinds of official accreditation. I mean, he doesn't make a secret of it. He doesn't kind of openly discuss it. Even when someone asks him point blank, he kind of talks about his previous career and now he's NASA. But remember, NASA is not a civilian agency. It is a military agency. Go back and read the charter in Dark Mission. Anyway, when you look at the whole thing, I believe that the president's, you know, discussion of returning to the moon and going on to Mars is another incredible lie. And I've been having vigorous debates with my, you know, space cadet friends who, like me, you know, were and still are true believers that mankind must inherit the solar system or die on planet Earth, that 99% of the problems that we face tonight, i.e. terrorism and pollution and environmental problems, greenhouse gases, you know, lack of a decent energy source, all of these would be solved by a viable, vigorous, truly civilian space effort that was honest, that would basically plug those extraordinary technological advances back into the economy and basically make everything the Republicans said in their debate tonight moot, because we wouldn't be operating with not only one hand but one foot tied behind our back. But instead, we appear to have this con game, and I'm using the word con game, to make even the believers in the aerospace community, the alt space community, which are the kind of private entrepreneurs, people like, you know, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the others who are using a tremendous amount of their own money
The Burt Rutans, those people.
Exactly. Private space programs. All that is pissing in the wind because officially this nation, this government will not allow real private space enterprise beyond low Earth orbit. And in terms of going back to the moon, I thought it was very telling that Hillary Clinton the other day came out with a policy statement basically saying that if she is elected president, actually she said when, that she will curtail the president's vision and focus more on NASA's science with robotic probes, et cetera, which of course means you can totally control what anyone sees from out there because robots, unlike people, are not, you know, it's not difficult to make them lie.
So, Mike, Mike Barra, you have worked with Richard for a long time. You've heard some of his theories about artifacts on Mars, artifacts on the moon. And now you're part of this, of course, with the website, of course, lunaranomalies.com. What did you think of those theories when he said there's a face, it's been made by some people on Mars?
Well, you know, I'd always been interested in that subject. I remembered it very clearly in 1976 when it appeared in my local newspaper, and there it was. And right away, NASA shot it down and said, "Oh no! It's not really a face." A couple of orbits later, you know, we took another picture, and it all went away. And that always bothered me a little bit. There were several other things that happened in that Viking summer, those Viking missions as well. There was one time where they thought they'd found what looked like writing on a couple of rocks. I remember Carl Sagan on Johnny Carson shooting that one down. And then, of course, they discovered life on Mars. The original experiments done by Gil Levin came through positive for microbial life on Viking, and they couldn't shoot that one down fast enough. So at that time, to me, I begin to think to myself, you know, they don't really seem to be doing what they say that they're doing. They don't really seem to be anxiously investigating this stuff. And then later on, I happened to be at work one day, and I saw, you know, one of Richard's videos. I think it was the UN briefing video. And I came away extremely impressed by his logic, his thoroughness, his detail. And as I got into this stuff and I started, you know, watching the other videos after he did the Ohio State one on the moon, I became more and more impressed because one of the things that he has that we don't talk about very much is he's got confirmation. He has, you know, objects that we have photographs of on the moon that are viewed from two different missions using different photographic mediums in the same place. And in fact, a lot of that work at the time, back in the mid-90s, was even confirmed by another independent group of scientists and engineers. And all that was presented back in the original D.C. press conference back in 96. So I knew he was right. I knew he was right very quickly about this stuff. The conspiracy stuff took a little longer, but I think any...
But he won you over with that, too.
Well, yeah,
well,
because, you know...
It wasn't me, George. It was the evidence.
Yeah, it was the evidence, and what really, really changed me was TWA 800, because I knew everything I knew as an aerospace engineer. I remember the night that it happened, and my wife said to me, what could make an airplane explode in midair like that? And I said, planes just don't explode in midair all by themselves. And that's when I knew, and now all the lies that were being told day after day after day during that investigation, I knew it was a bomb or a missile right away, because simply... What they claim happened, that the fuel tank just exploded, is utterly ridiculous. And I think I don't know anybody who really, really understands aircraft engineering who believes that happened. So then I begin to realize if the government or the NTSB would lie about that for whatever their reasons were.
Well, we know what their reasons were. Panic.
Right. And there was an election coming up and numerous other things. Then, you know, it seemed to me that they would really lie about other things. And,
particularly, gentlemen, when there are no bodies involved.
Yeah.
Remember, when you're dealing with terrorism on Earth, you have a body count, you have victims, you have tragedy. When you're dealing with data on an ET civilization in the solar system, of which the human race is not supposed to know it was once an incredible part of it, there's no downside. They can lie till the cows come home, and if they're caught, it's like, oops, sorry.
Yeah.
Richard, when you say, though, you have the evidence, and Mike, you have the evidence about, let's say, the face on Mars, and that NASA, for example, as you write, deliberately altered pictures from the surface to make the planet look more alien. How do you know this? Where's the real proof here?
Well, okay, I can tell you, for one thing, that last reference that you made on the color pictures that have come back from Viking and from Mars Pathfinder, and we detail this all in Dark Mission, you can plainly prove that they have altered the color of not only the sky, but of the entire image to make the whole planet Mars look this technicolor red, as we like to call it. You have controls, you have color dials, you have pictures of American flags that are on the side of Viking, and you can plainly see that the color has been tweaked way, way, way over into the red to make the images appear red. You also have stories, documented stories, like that of, again, Dr. Gil Levin, who ran the label release experiment that came back positive for life on Viking and was subsequently shot down by NASA. And he was sitting in JPL when the first images of Mars came back, and it looked like Arizona, blue skies, brown rocks, you know, you had some even greenish splotches on some of the rocks. And then some guy came through on the order of headquarters and turned all the color dials way over to the red to make it look red. And in addition to that,
let me make one correction. It was not only Levin, it was also Levin's son.
So there was more than one witness.
Who is now a PhD physicist, George, at MIT, and has written about this extensively. How he, as a teenager, you know, teenagers have no fear. So when he saw the NASA deal coming around and basically changing on the orders from up top somewhere, he didn't know where the orders were coming from, changing all the monitors to red, he went around and switched them all back so Mars looked like Earth again, the way the actual official image on the screen had initially appeared. Well, Jim Martin, who was the project manager of Viking at that time from Langley, called him into his office, and Gil said that he was sitting in an outside office and looking through the glass, and he saw the project manager yelling at his teenage son, who was working as an intern on the mission. A lot of the PIs, the principal investigators, had been able to bring their teenage children to work on the mission so they could get a feel for science as it was really being done. I mean, incredible experience for a young person, up and until the head of the project dresses you down in front of everybody for tweaking the color controls on a monitor. And then he was told, Levin's son was told, that he would be thrown off campus, ejected from JPL, not able to come back, you know, to his intern job unless he left the monitors alone. Some years later, we find from Levin's own testimony in this written essay that he's done, which is available on the web, and part of it is, I think, quoted in Dark Mission, he said that the head of NASA himself, who at that time was a Mormon from Utah named, come on, Mike, help me.
I don't remember, honestly, at that time.
What year? What year?
It was 1976.
Not Jastrow.
No. Jastrow was never head of NASA.
Okay.
Someone will come up with it.
We'll get it for you.
Anyway, he actually called the head of the project at JPL and ordered him to destroy the negative, which showed a blue Martian sky and an Arizona-like Martian terrain that had been beamed down from Viking at 5-something in the morning on the first day after they had landed. Now, in any scientific process, to authoritatively and administratively order data to be destroyed, I mean, why didn't they put it in the archive and say, as they said to us in the press conference, because remember, I was there covering for CBS, well, when we took a careful look at the filters and calibrated the photos, turned out we had infrared leakage, and this photo is not exactly what Mars looks like. Here's a more accurate. No, they didn't do that. They ordered him. This particular individual, the administrator of NASA, ordered the head of the project to destroy that blue sky Mars negative. Fortunately, enough people in the press kept their copies of the color prints, and with the web, they got published all over the world, so there's no way to keep that little, you know, secret in a drawer anymore. But this shows you the length to which NASA will go to intimidate people, to change data, to foster some kind of political appreciation for a very hostile, very unearthly, very alien Mars And obviously, you got to ask the question, why would they go to the trouble of doing all that?
Well, was it Jim Fletcher, by the way?
Jim Fletcher, exactly.
Okay, there you
Thanks
go.
Thanks once again to the Coast audience.
Yes, they're there. I got a million Jim Fletchers for you. Thanks. Thanks. Well, okay. So they doctor photographs.
Yeah.
Why? Mm-hmm. Why? Why don't why don't you say the planet looks Earth-like and it's got a blue sky, which means it's got some kind of an atmosphere? Mike, why?
My 30-second take, and then Mike can take it from there.
All right.
The bottom line is NASA is a lie. It's a lie. I will repeat, it's a lie. Even the people who work there don't realize the depth of the lie. We're not looking for life out there. We've never been looking for life out there. We will slap down anybody who finds life out there. Talk to Gil Levin if you don't believe that. And I got a story, you know, for later on if we have time to kind of reinforce that. So everything about NASA is designed to make us think the Earth is unique, the Earth is the only home for life, the Earth is the only wonderful, nice, benign place in the solar system, and the more alien and weird and terrifyingly unappealing they can make Mars, the more no serious scientist will have the courage to say, but wait a minute, what about those readings we got when we landed and picked up the soil and put it in the hopper and we got all that extraordinary evidence of actual life according to our pre-mission scenarios?
I'm going to do something right now, and I'm going to have Tommy take the percentage results for us that we can reveal in the last hour, Richard and Michael, when we take phone calls. And that is whether people agree with you two or not with regards to NASA being the lie.
Okay.
Is that fair?
George, with that, it's premature. We need to give them a couple of weeks. They need to read their copies of Dark Mission with the evidence, the documentation, the memos, the footnotes.
All right.
Because, George, really, to me, the whole point of Dark Mission, what I wanted to achieve with it, is that by the end of the read, what I wanted and hoped was that no reasonably open-minded person would be able to close that book up, having read the entire thing, and say, NASA has been honest and told us the truth about not everything, but anything in the last 50 years.
Would you two sit across at CNN or Fox News or any place else, sit across from NASA administrators and NASA people and say what you're saying to us tonight?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would ask them some, I would love to be able to debate them the kind of the way we have, you know, they have these debates, these political debates for the presidency. I'd love to be able to debate them or get them into a court of law, because there are so many things that have been said. Even recently, what's his name, Jim Garvin was on a National Geographic program about Mars, making some absolutely ridiculous claims about some of the objects at Cydonia that he knows, he categorically has to know, are simply not true. And I would love the opportunity to stare them right in the face. In fact, one of the stories we tell in the book, in Dark Mission, is back at Caltech in 2003 when I went and did that exact thing at a conference, a Mars conference at Caltech.
I mean, one of the things that Mike and I hope would happen tonight is that this Coast audience that's followed this story for decades would be able to involve themselves in this process. Because this is not about a book tonight. I mean, we have published most of this data, I would say 90% of it, on the Enterprise Mission website.
Over the years. Over the years.
And people have ignored it. The reason is very simple. We live in a culture that operates by certain rules. Politically, you're not taken seriously, certainly as a threat to an agency as august as NASA, unless you have a book. Now, I am very heartened tonight to be able to report to people that our book is number 241 on Amazon out of several million books listed. We're in the top 300.
Oh, you'll go much higher than that.
Up and up and up. That means an awful lot of people, by word of mouth and by basically seeing what the subject matter of our investigation is going to cover in this 600-page book, because it's not a light book, it's a very heavy book, had to be to contain this data, they are willing to bet the farm before there is even a book that they can critique among each other. Those are pre-orders at Amazon.
Stay with us, Richard. Stay, hold the line here. We'll be back with you and Mike Bearer in just a moment. That hour was as fast as a rocket ship. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.